You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the giant ship that got stuck in the Suez Canal can tell us a lot about the state of global supply chains and where they're vulnerable. An expert on shipping joins us with lessons learned. Now, President Biden says the Justice Department is, quote, taking a look at Georgia's new election law. The measure requires voter ID for absentee ballots, limits the use of ballot drop boxes, and gives state officials more power over elections. It also makes it illegal to offer voters food and water as they wait in line. Governor Brian Kemp signed the bill into law last week. Critics are calling it a voter suppression tactic and a legislative power grab. Kemp says it's designed to protect the state's elections.
It's an election security bill that actually increases early voting opportunities on the weekend here in Georgia. Also requires a photo ID for absentee by mail, just like when you vote in person. And it continues to, I think, will allow Georgia to have secure, accessible, fair elections in Georgia.
Meanwhile, Republicans in dozens of other states are looking for election changes in the wake of the 2020 presidential election. This comes as Democrats in Congress work to pass a federal voting rights bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about a Republican-led effort to tighten up election laws around the country? Do you think it's a good idea for voting security? Do you worry that it's an act of voter suppression? Do you want to see the federal government pass voting rights protections that would apply to all states? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's the editor of the Election Law Journal and is affiliated with the Elections Research Center. David, good to have you back on the show.
Good to be with you.
Let's start in Georgia. How big a deal do you think this set of new election laws in Georgia is?
Well, there's no doubt that some of the changes were clearly aimed at trying to suppress the vote in Democratic areas. And so if you look at things like the drop boxes, those are being used more heavily in Fulton County in Atlanta, where Democratic voters are concentrated. With the one that's been getting a lot of attention is the no food or drink for voters waiting in line. And the place where you have lines, of course, is in the urban areas. And so what happens sometimes you get the lines that are 3-4 hours long. People haven't had dinner yet. They get discouraged and they go home. So one way that people try to keep people in line is to, you know, go order out pizza and get some food for people waiting in line. And so that's something I think that is clearly aimed at the Fulton County, Atlanta voters as well. And then also things like the voter ID requirement for absentee ballots that before this election, you know, before these changes, that it was just a signature requirement. They didn't have to have a voter ID for absentee ballots the way we do in Wisconsin. And that does have a bigger impact on the voters who are non-white voters are less likely to have a valid state-issued ID that would count as the ID for those absentee ballots. So those are all changes that do seem to be aimed at trying to cut down on the access of more voters who are more likely to lean Democratic.
President Biden was asked what he thinks of Georgia's law. Here's some of what he had to say.
It's an atrocity. The idea, if you want any indication that it has nothing to do with fairness, nothing to do with decency, they passed a law saying you can't provide water for people standing in line while they're waiting to vote. You don't need anything else to know that this is nothing but punitive, designed to keep people from voting.
That's what President Biden says. But how much does the president or the Justice Department have to say about what goes on in Georgia election law?
Well, so there was a lawsuit filed already just today in U.S. District Court under the Voting Rights Act saying that, you know, if there is an impact on the ability of minority voters to have an equal opportunity to vote, then this could be, you know, parts of it could be struck down under the Voting Rights Act. Now, it seems unlikely that's going to happen, you know, given that the impact would have to be shown typically until, like they don't stop something proactively. That part of the Voting Rights Act was struck down several years ago in another decision, the Shelby decision. And so now you have to wait to show impact on racial impact on voting before a practice can be struck down. So it's going to be harder to change these laws now that they are in effect. Now, one other thing that should be mentioned, though, about the Georgia laws that hasn't been getting as much attention, there are actually a few changes in the law that really, I think, are positive changes in terms of affecting voters' confidence in the integrity of the voting process, and in at least in one case, you know, probably making it easier to vote down the road as well. And that one, the one that's going to make it easier to vote, is that part of the law says that for any precinct in which the wait time was longer than 1 hour at some point during the day, or if people were still in line for up to an hour after the polls closed, those precincts have to either add more poll workers for the next election, or they have to decrease the size of the precinct to make it a smaller precinct. And so they are, this is for precincts more than 2,000 voters. So that would actually help voter access. They also allowed poll workers to be from adjoining counties. And under the previous law, you had to be from the county you lived in order to be a poll worker. Now, in order to address the shortage of poll workers, they've allowed more poll workers by saying you can be from the adjoining county. So that should help a bit as well. Also, another change I think that's good is that they made absentee ballot requests have to be 2 weeks before the election, because one thing that was happening is people would wait until 1 week before the election, which was the old deadline, and 1 week to request your ballot is not enough time because clerk's offices are overwhelmed. They often would take them several days to get the ballot out. You would get it, and by the time you mailed it in, it would be too late. And so a lot of ballots are being rejected because they were being received after the deadline. And so now by having that deadline to request ballots move from 1 week before the election to 2 weeks before the election, I think that also will help voters have a better chance of not having their ballots be thrown out.
Talking to David Cannon from UW-Madison, political scientist there, looking at election law changes in Georgia, others in the works around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there changes you'd like to see in voting here in Wisconsin, big or small? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. David, in the partisan battle over this, I think, you know, some of these Republican efforts, people are saying, oh, they're an attack on election access, the ability to people to vote. A Republican say, hey, we've got this big problem of fraud that we're tackling here. Are both sides overstating their cases to some extent, or do you think there's some merit on either or both?
Well, there really is almost no basis for the claim of serious voter fraud. That's something we've heard now for the last 10 years or so, that we have this huge problem with fraud, and so we have to, you know, crack down on access to voting. There is really like very, very few cases of voter fraud that have actually been verified over the last 20 years. And so that claim is really baseless. On the other side, with Democrats saying that these changes, you know, are across the board leading to voter suppression, you know, some of these changes, as the ones I just mentioned, actually will help the process of voting. And so I think you have to look specifically at what's being done. And I think there are some places where we should see some bipartisan agreement on things we can do to actually either help the integrity of the voting process or to actually make it easier to vote in a way that, you know, would also make sure that more votes are getting counted, like that change I mentioned of making sure that people request their ballot at least 2 weeks ahead of time. That's just kind of common sense. Like, you can't both, you know, have the time for the clerk to fill out the paperwork and mail you the ballot and send it back in within 1 week. That's just cutting it too close. And so there should be some changes like that, I think, that both will, you know, help voter confidence in the process and also improve access to voting.
We're talking about ongoing efforts by Republicans in some states to change election laws and Democrats at the federal level. We'll get to in just a bit. David Cannon is with us, professor of political science at UW-Madison, editor of the Election Law Journal, and affiliated with the Elections Research Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we need to change the way we do voting and elections around the country here in Wisconsin? Would you like to see more federal standards to take out some of the variation from state to state? Or do you think states should remain in control of most parts of how voting works? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now we're talking about possible changes in voting laws around the country. Republicans in many states offering changes. Georgia became the latest state to change laws as Governor Brian Kemp there signed several bills into law. David Cannon is with us from UW-Madison, political scientist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions and changes you'd like to see in voting laws. Were there things that were done kind of in the scramble during COVID that you think worked out pretty well? You want to keep them? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Alicia is with us in Madison. Alicia, hi.
Hi. I was calling because I heard that two conflicting things. One was that you couldn't pass out any food to people at polls. And the other was that you could give it to poll workers who were then able to pass it out. And I was wondering if it's true that you can give food to poll workers to have it passed out. And if so, is that what other states do? And how is this practice then a bad thing? Does that make sense?
Alicia, thanks for the call. I guess I haven't dug into it in that level of granular detail. David, do they specify how food can be passed along?
Yeah, so my reading of the law is that it is a strict prohibition against any food or water of anyone standing in line within 25 feet, in fact, of anyone standing in line. Now, I have seen two different interpretations of the 150-foot limit. One interpretation I read said that if the line is longer than 150 feet, then you can give food and water to the people outside that 150 foot distance. But the other reading, which I think is actually the more accurate, when you actually read the language of the bill, it sounded to me from the language of the bill that you can't even get within 25 feet of anyone in a line of people waiting in line to vote. And that I think is the correct interpretation of the law. Now, one thing though, that also is in the law, which is an important thing, I think, given that some elections in Georgia could, you know, like primaries could happen in very hot weather where people could be passing out if they don't have water, is that it is okay to have a self-serve water fountain accessible to people voting in line. And so it is okay for voters themselves to go up and get some water if you make a water fountain available to them, and that would be okay.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Marty now in Racine. Marty, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Marty?
Well, I was just curious. I forgot his first name or last name for that matter, but I was just curious. So he talked a little bit about, well, I'm not really sure why it would be an issue to bring up to eliminate the ID process in voting. It doesn't sound like it would make the voting process, you know, the integrity of the voting process any better. I think that having a voter ID law for the election is a good idea, being that I need one to drive, I need one to buy alcohol, anything like that, but to actually vote without an ID, I think that in itself produces some integrity. And I'm just curious to see what's the thought process behind not having an ID when it comes to voting. And
gotcha.
Why,
Marty, thanks a lot for the call. So Marty's saying he feels more comfortable with elections with those voter IDs verifying David who's voting.
Right. And certainly that is I think, supported by like 75-80% of the American public would agree with Marty on that, that it is, you know, I think one of the election reforms that in a lot of states here in Wisconsin, we have a fairly, you know, strict voter ID law that, in fact, now is comparable to what Georgia has. We had a stricter law before than Georgia did. Now, Georgia basically has the same law that we do on voter ID when it comes to absentee ballots, especially. And so the argument saying we shouldn't have to have a voter ID is that there are up to about 10% of eligible voters who don't have a state-issued ID that qualifies for an ID for voting. And so that is provides a serious obstacle to voting. Now, in states do have to provide a free ID to people who can't afford an ID. But that is, and that's again another hurdle for people to overcome. They have to go get the ID, you know, first, and then they have to register to vote. Because previously, you just had to show proof of residence. You could bring like a utility bill or a bank statement or something else that had your address. And that for many years, so up until about 4 years ago in Wisconsin, that's all we needed to vote was just to be able to show proof of residence. We didn't have to show a photo ID when we could vote. To be able to vote. And you could even have a neighbor vouch for your residence if you know, didn't have paperwork with you. And so it is harder to vote now in Wisconsin because of that voter ID requirement. But that is the big concern, is you have up to about 10% of the population that actually doesn't have an ID. So for those of us who do have an ID, it's not an inconvenience. But for someone who doesn't, it could basically disenfranchise them. And it is minority voters, younger voters, and some elderly voters. For example, if you're in a nursing home, you don't have a driver's license anymore, you might not have a valid state-issued ID. And so there are people who, it is an inconvenience if they don't have an ID, and it could prevent them from voting.
Thanks for that call. We are talking to David Cannon, political scientist at UW-Madison, about changes in the works in states, maybe at the federal level, in the way we vote. Back to your calls now. Gary is with us in Strum. Gary, hello.
How you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Gary?
My thing is I think really it should be the standard across all states, not, changing rules within states. I think everybody should have a ability to vote and have enough time to get everybody voted. Because if you're limiting voting in any way, I guess as our population grows, we don't, really are not making accommodations for that. So I think really all states should be really under the same kind of voting regulations rather than having everybody changing their rules to fit their needs.
Gary, thanks for the call. David, why don't we have federal standards and decide things at the state level?
Well, yeah, Gary makes a really good point. This is something we're having a lot of debate about in Congress right now, because the House passed H.R. 1 a little while ago, which was a national voting rights bill that would apply to the entire country in ways that would provide more access to voting by increasing access to mail-in voting. It would make Election Day itself a national holiday. It would provide access to same-day registration the way we have here in Wisconsin, make that available in every state. And I think most significantly, make for automatic voter registration. And that last one actually is a good example of something that seems like both Democrats and Republicans should be able to get on board on. Because if you have automatic voter registration, it helps address one of the Republicans' big concerns in previous elections, which has been the integrity of the voter files themselves. Because people do move away from the state, people die, and you need to keep the voter rolls up to date. And so if you have automatic voter registration, it makes that process much easier than it otherwise would be. So it both helps the integrity of the voter rolls, and it provides easier access to voting.
As you said, that election, that federal election law passed in the House, but it might not in the Senate. What have been the objections to it?
Yeah, so the Senate, it looks like it really doesn't have much of a chance as long as the filibuster is in place. Because, with a filibuster, you need 60 votes to stop a filibuster. And it's not even entirely clear you'd be able to get all of the 50 Democrats to support this, but you might be able to. But some of the objections are on things like requiring nonpartisan redistricting commissions in every state. A lot of the Republican senators don't want to do that. Also, the easier access to mail-in voting. That became a real sort of partisan issue in this last election, where the mail-in voting was used much more heavily for the first time, really, to have a huge partisan difference in mail-in voting. But Democrats were much more likely to vote by mail in 2020, whereas Republicans were much more likely to vote in person on election day. And so any effort to increase mail-in voting is seen as as Mitch McConnell calls it, a partisan power grab, basically. And so this is something that is unlikely to pass the Senate in the current form.
All of these changes we're looking at, and there are a lot more in other states that we haven't talked about as much. do they just affect overall voter turnout on either side around the margins? Or do you think there are states, close states like a Georgia or a Wisconsin, where tweaking the rules a little could sway, especially statewide elections?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that especially when you look at a really close state like Georgia, there's no doubt that these changes could potentially affect the results of a statewide election. And then one other aspect of the Georgia changes that we're seeing in some other states too, like in Arizona, they've proposed changes along these lines, is not just changes in access to voting, but also changes in control over the election process, and especially over the administration of elections. So one thing that happened in the Georgia law is they sort of diminished the role of the Secretary of State, who had been the top election official and chaired the state election board there. You might remember the Raffensperger, the Republican Secretary of State, the one that kind of stood up to Donald Trump and said, hey, we had a secure election here. And we had two recounts, full audit. You lost, President Trump. And Trump supporters didn't like that. So they downgraded the power of the Secretary of State in Georgia as a consequence. And they also took over a review ability over the county election officials, which the state election board had not had that power before. So there's concern that you could add a partisan element there, you know, where, say, Fulton County, which votes heavily Democratic, you now have the state election board that would be able to oversee that county board, or that county election process, which you haven't had before. So that's a bigger issue, I think, where it's not just the access to voting, but it's actual control over the process of counting votes as well and how votes will be reported.
Briefly, do you worry about that? I mean, we saw a lot of pressure, not just in Georgia, but Michigan and elsewhere, to impose outside forces on the counting of the vote. Is that something that could be a problem just in our last 30 seconds in the future, David?
It potentially could be. I mean, one thing that I took great confidence in from the 2020 experience was the fact that the court stepped up and prevented that kind of thing from happening. You know, that they really did play their role of an independent judiciary that prevented state legislatures from trying to step in and take some power over the process. And so one would hope that that same kind of judicial restraint will be in place if state legislatures try to go too far in taking power.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
David Cannon is professor of political science at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at election overhaul bills in Georgia and elsewhere. Coming up, a big ship blocked the Suez Canal for about a week. We'll look at what it means for consumers around the world. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take your calls on what wildlife you've been seeing re-emerge now that winter is, by and large, behind us. Now, the giant ship that was blocking the Suez Canal for 6 days has finally been unstuck. The boat is one of the largest container ships in the world. Bloomberg estimated that for every single day the ship was stuck in the canal, it blocked nearly $10 billion of international commerce, and ports from Italy to California felt the effect. How could one traffic jam have such a wide-reaching impact? We're talking about our reliance on global supply chains and how fragile that system can be. Pierre David is a professor of business administration at Baldwin Wallace University in Ohio. He's the author of International Logistics, the Management of International Trade Operations. Pierre, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
What is your read, Pierre, on the economic impact of this backup for that last 6 days?
Well, it's a little bit like, I won't call it the nail in the coffin, but it's certainly something that is added to the COVID problems that we've had recently, and that is certainly going to add and have an impact on the global supply chain. We are going to experience delays. We are going to experience reduced productions in many places and probably increased prices.
And I got to say, Pierre, I think I probably am like a lot of people. I overlook the impact of this shipping container revolution and how it changed the way stuff moves around the world. Can you talk about how much we rely on these container ships and the cargo they haul?
Yes, the container was created in 1956, so a little bit more than 50 years ago, by a fellow named Malcolm McLean. And he was looking for a way to, he was a truck driver or trucking company executive or owner, and he wanted to reduce the cost of shipping goods in the United States. And he created the box. And that box, 20 footer long or 40 foot long, is something that has revolutionized international trade. It facilitates transportation a lot because the cargo that is loaded in a container by the exporter is only seen and handled again by the importer, however many miles that may be. And today there are roughly 20 million of those boxes in use in the world, which is an incredibly large number. And they represent for manufactured goods probably about 90% of the value of the goods that is traded internationally.
So if I go to the store and buy a thing, or if I go online and have a thing shipped to me, odds are that either the whole thing or at least its components came over in one of these containers? Is that right?
I would say the odds are pretty close to 100%, yes.
Now, oceans are big. You've got a lot of lanes you can drive a ship through there. The Suez Canal, though, can you talk about why that is such a significant piece of shipping, this narrow man-made channel?
Well, that's something that was built by the French in the mid-19th century because the alternative was to go around the entire continent of Africa. And at that time, the time saving was something along the lines of 3 to 4 weeks. Today, the time saving, depending on where the ship is coming from, that is, if the ship is coming from Singapore, for example, and passes around the island of Sumatra and then heads for the Cape of Good Hope and then eventually to Europe, that ship, by going through Panama Canal, Suez Canal, is going to save roughly 9 days of shipping and probably about $20,000 to $25,000 a day in fuel costs.
9 days doesn't sound like that much, but the way our global supply chains work, how big a difference is 9 days if I'm waiting for my oil shipment or my component shipment at my factory, say?
I think that this is a very significant number because most of companies are running on a just-in-time system, which is that the goods that arrive in the container are essentially ready to be placed into a final product. Essentially, assembly line does not have any inventory, and all goods arrive just in time to be placed onto this final assembly. And a 9-day delay is a significant delay over, you know, obtaining it right away, to the point where it will shut down a plant if it cannot get a critical part that is currently, you know, traveling around the Horn of Africa.
Talking to Pierre David from Baldwin-Wallace University in Ohio, author of the book International Logistics, talking about the economic impact of the blockage of the Suez Canal for 6 days there and what it tells us about our supply chain from producing countries to factories to us. And Pierre, this makes me wonder about what is security like on a place like the Suez Canal? Because I imagine if a government that wanted to disrupt the international economy or a non-governmental actor who had the same goal was looking at this thinking, wait, if I could sink a ship, say, in the Suez Canal, I could really disrupt the global economy. How secure a place is this?
I do not know the level of security that is currently in place on the Suez Canal. However, the scenario that you mentioned already has happened. During the 6-day war between Israel and Egypt, the Israelis sank ships in the Suez Canal, and the Suez Canal was inoperable for, this is from memory now, 5 or 6 years. And that was at the time at which we were using a lot of oil from the Middle East, especially the European countries were. And all of a sudden, cargo that was going through Suez and oil that was going through Suez had to go through around Africa. And what happened is that all of a sudden we were left with too little capacity in shipping because 9 days for a ship in one direction and 9 days for a ship in the other direction, and all of a sudden you are seeing a decrease in capacity that is substantial on what we can move in terms of oil. And that was, at the time, eventually aggravated by the oil embargo of 1973. So we had a double whammy there between the end of the Six-Day War, which was 1967 from memory, and 1973, the oil embargo by OPEC.
And speaking of capacity, I've been reading, and you mentioned the impact of the pandemic on shipping already, even before this incident, that we're having a thing where, correct me if I'm wrong, containers are stacking up at one point where things are being delivered, and there are shortages of containers in some places that need them to ship things. Is that right? And has this Suez thing made it even worse?
That's correct. Well, the pandemic has made it much worse for empties, as we call them, that are left in some areas of the world and are needed somewhere else. Because of the capacity restriction due to COVID, the international trade was somewhat reduced. They were there was an impact on ports. Ports ended up not being open as much, having less personnel, and so on and so forth. So shipping lines did not move empty containers as willingly as they did in the past. So what has happened is there's a shortage of containers in places that export a lot, such as China, Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore, Hong Kong, places like this. And there is a surplus of empties in places like Western Europe and the United States. So this imbalance was aggravated further because those ships that waited first 6 days in Suez are going to be delayed going through Suez because there are roughly 300 ships that have that are currently waiting, and the capacity of the canal to handle those ships in convoys of six or seven ships is going to be reduced. So they are going to have to wait their turns, and the backlog is probably going to last easily a week and a half, if not longer. And basically what it does is that there is yet added lack of capacity, both in empties and in container ships.
Do you think there are lessons here for those manufacturers you mentioned earlier who do that just-in-time process, where, great, it saves money today, but if there's a disruption, it can really lose a lot of money in the future?
This is a significant discussion in industry right now, and this is another example of a disruption that had not quite been anticipated that is forcing companies to reconsider a couple of things. Maybe not international trade, because the cost savings are so substantial that they want to keep those suppliers from China, from Thailand, from Brazil to ship goods to the United States or Western Europe, but mostly from what is referred to as single sourcing, which is one supplier in the world provides us with that particular part. And they are looking at increasing the number of suppliers. Now, we've had that experience in the past with disruptions, for example, the Fukushima tsunami about 5 years ago or so caused a fair number of companies to reconsider having only one supplier for certain products that were manufactured in northern Japan. The Suez incident is likely to force companies to reconsider having a single source in China or single source in Singapore for the products that they are importing. Some other companies may decide to do what we call reshoring, which is moving production capacity or supplier capacity from Asia to a place like Mexico, because the disruptions that exist between Mexico and the United States are fewer, and therefore there is a greater probability of getting the goods on time for production.
Pierre, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
That's Pierre David, professor of business administration at Baldwin Wallace University in Ohio, author of the book International Logistics. He joined us for a look at the big ship that was stuck in the Suez Canal and the economic impact that had. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about parenthood during the pandemic.
Bringing a new life into this world is a blessing, and being able to share a newborn with family and friends is one of the biggest joys parents can have. But the coronavirus pandemic has taken these moments away from many families, leaving them with a slew of emotions to work through. WPR's Andrea Anderson shares these feelings in a letter to her newborn, Magnolia.
Dearest Magnolia, I write part of the story on my phone as we snuggle in the rocking chair and you drift to sleep. One of the dogs quietly peeks his head through the baby gate and then walks away. The cat purrs nearby, wishing she could be sitting on the chair's armrest. As I feel your warmth and hear your teeny soft snores, I think about the world you were born into in June. It's a world where millions have died from a new virus that has torn the global economy apart and turned life upside down. It's a world where your sister's is normal is but a memory and also a goal as they yearn for hangouts with friends, birthday parties, and seeing your cousins. But the world isn't all bad at this time. People have come together like never before in some ways, working to help those in need. Sweet Magnolia, you were born into a house and family full of love in one of the darkest times this world has seen. And while many people, including me, struggle to see the light, you are that light our family needs. We made plans with your grandparents to come and visit right after you were born. But March came and our plans looked like a distant dream in the midst of a pandemic. We'd say optimistically at the end of Zoom calls and FaceTimes, maybe June will be different. But June came and the world was no better. Except for you. You were born into so much love, but only four people could share you. Your two sisters, your father, and me. Your grandparents waited at their faraway homes for text messages with pictures and videos. They waited for video calls. After a two-week quarantine, just a couple weeks after you were born, they finally got to hold you because we posed no risk. Imagine, a newborn, only a few weeks old, could pose a lethal risk to her own grandparents. It was unimaginable, yet our reality. Your little, beautiful self filled their hearts with joy. It was as if I could see their bodies recharging every second they held you. They didn't want to let you go because they didn't know when they'd get to see you again. It made me cry. The visits came to an end and we hoped we'd see them soon, but the pandemic continued. The milestones you reach, sweet Magnolia, have been celebrated. But for each one you make, a part of me breaks inside because your village can't see her first in person. You bring so much laughter and joy. Your giggles are the best when your sisters make funny faces and rub their nose to yours, or when they tickle your belly. Your chattering in the morning is the best alarm clock. Your wobbly wave is the cutest. The four of us get to experience your deep sighs and your snuggles, your infectious smile. We get to see you roll over, then crawl, then stand. We hear you say, hey, and dada. See, Magnolia, this pandemic has robbed so many people of so many things. It's not fair. No one ever asked for this to be how it is, but no matter what, we have you and all the future memories to share with your village. This will all come to an end someday, but for now, sweet Magnolia, you remain our hope and our light.
WPR's Andrea Anderson shares a letter that she wrote to her newborn, Magnolia. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we want to hear the wildlife report from your neck of the woods, your yard, your back 40, neighborhood, local state park. What creatures have you been seeing so far this spring? Flying, swimming, crawling, you name it. Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org with your wildlife sightings, maybe from over the weekend. We'll take your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, sandhill cranes have been soaring back high above us or stilt walking through fields hunting for food. squirrels, well, they've been around all along, but they're running around hoping to remember all the places they buried their food. The natural world is reemerging right before our eyes, and we want to know what you have been seeing or hearing. Did you have any cool sightings over the winter? What animals have you seen in your neck of the woods that are a sure sign the seasons are turning over? Favorite migratory birds showing up, maybe? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your local wildlife report. Let's go right to your calls now. Maria is with us in Mequonago. Maria, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right. What do you got for us, Maria?
Well, a flock of white pelicans.
Where'd you see those?
We saw them 2 days in a row, too. So they were out in Vernon Marsh, which is outside of Mequonago.
And are these regular visitors? Do you see these guys every year, or is this a first time seeing them?
No, this was the first time, and it was incredible. They were beautiful. So they were feeding one night, and then the second night, it was like looking at little gondoliers going across the across the water. They were just more separate, is what I'm trying to imply. They were like just floating and enjoying life.
Cool.
Awesome.
And did you hear them, too? I don't know what a pelican sounds like.
No, other than like when they would flutter their wings and you know, maybe cackle a little bit at each other, but generally pretty quiet.
Fantastic, Maria. Thank you so much for starting us off at 800-642-1234 with your wildlife sighting. I was I didn't see them. I heard frogs in a local marshy area, which is pretty cool. Very noisy, actually, yesterday afternoon. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Angus is with us in Sauk County. Angus, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to report that I've been seeing lots of juvenile spiders coming out at night in the woods.
Okay, cool. So they've been wading through the winter. I think of like late fall is when I see the big spiders all over the place. What woods are you seeing them in?
Well, specifically in like wetlands and swamps. Uh-huh. I think they come out at night, and you can, if you shine a flashlight around, you can see lots of webs glistening, and then you look for a tiny little ball hanging in the middle of the web. Can find a lot.
Cool. You got to have an eye for detail. Angus, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Emily in South Milwaukee. Emily, hello.
Good afternoon. I am an avid wildlife watcher, so I was excited for this question. I don't think I have anything too exotic, but so far, since winter has ended, I've seen a fox, possums, raccoons. I've seen a red squirrel, gray squirrel. I saw a chipmunk emerge. And then as far as birds, we're seeing American robins. I started seeing some cowbirds, and grackles are back.
Have you seen these all in your? Are these all in your yard, Emily, or are you out looking for them in nature?
Both. I mean, I pretty obsessively watch the backyard, especially now that I'm working from home and live near Grant Park. So, I mean, I try to catch everything.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for sharing the roster with us. I appreciate it, Emily. We're taking your wildlife sightings right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let us know what you've seen on the ground, in the sky, on the water. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Pewaukee. Bill, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What have you seen, Bill?
Well, I've lived in Wisconsin my whole life, and I know the sandhill cranes are coming back pretty strong, but about a couple, like 2 weeks ago, I heard them, and then I like searching the sky for them, and I saw a group that I would guess was between 30 and 40 birds.
Wow.
Flying in a V formation, kind of like the you know, the Canadian geese do, but it was really unusual because they were also staggered one above each other, and I started counting one line back, got to almost 20, I think, and they kind of circled and reconfigured, but I have never seen that many sandhills in one group flying. It was really neat.
I have never seen that many at one time either, Bill. And were they noisy about it?
They were. They were. Like I said, I could hear them for quite a while before I ever could get my eyes on them. And like I said, usual, at first look, I thought, oh, it was geese. But then I noticed they were, like I said, it was staggered weird. And it was for sure sandhills.
Awesome.
But I've never seen that many in one place together, especially flying. So it was really kind of neat. Neat sight to see them coming back as healthy.
I love it.
You know, that great of numbers.
Thanks, Bill. Time for another caller at least. Alyssa is with us in Thorpe. Alyssa, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that last weekend I actually saw three beavers, two pairs of swans, and an albino deer.
Wow. Where was this?
This is near the Shawamigan Flowage.
Okay.
near the Shawamigan Nicolet Forest.
Wow. I think you win on the bingo card, Alyssa. That is fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Well, I think that's all the time we have. You can keep on sharing your wildlife sightings. Why don't you tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR. Or you can send an email, ideas@WPR.org. Thanks for all your calls. That was fun. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it is the morning show. Tomorrow at 7, North Korea has been a foreign policy challenge for a long list of American presidents. We'll find out what's facing President Biden, and you can join in with your questions and comments. That's tomorrow at 7 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then, will robots take our jobs? We'll talk about how to future-proof our own lives with the author of a new book. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.